Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining today's conference call. I'm Elizabeth Kerr with Business Forward, and I'll be moderating our conversation today. Currently, all of your lines are in listen-only mode. Today, we will discuss the current debate on healthcare in Washington and a proposal from Congressman Kurt Schrader and a new Democrat coalition aimed at stabilizing the health insurance marketplace that exists under the Affordable Care Act. It's still a little bit unclear if the Senate will vote this week on legislation to repeal and possibly replace that law, and Congressman Schrader and a group of his colleagues have suggested changes to the law rather than full replacement. He represents the 5th District of Oregon and is co-chair of the New Democrat Coalition's Affordable and Accessible Healthcare Task Force. This is an interactive phone briefing, so after the Congressman's remarks, we'll open it up for your questions and also to get your advice on how to improve our nation's healthcare system. For those of you who are new to our programming, Business Forward organizes local roundtables, Washington fly-ins, conference calls, webinars, and media trainings for more than 100,000 business leaders across the country. And at these briefings, entrepreneurs, investors, small business owners, and executives all get the chance to brief policymakers on issues that affect their businesses and their bottom line and make suggestions about how Washington can work better with businesses to accelerate the economy. More than 550 administration officials, members of Congress, governors, and mayors have participated in that programming, and we're pleased to have Congressman Schrader with us today. This is all thanks to the support of more than 60 of America's largest and most respected companies. Before we get started, I need to cover just a few housekeeping items. First, this call is on the record and there may be reporters on the line. Second, we are recording this call and we'll share it with you in the follow-up email you receive after the call. Also, as I mentioned earlier, this is an interactive phone briefing and there will be time for you to ask questions and share your advice after the Congressman's remarks. To ask a question, you can do one of two things. If you'd like to ask your question live, please press 1 on your telephone keypad and we will call on you. Or if you prefer, please feel free to email your question to us at info@businessfwd.org and I'll read that aloud for you. So once again, if you'd like to ask a question, you can press 1 on your telephone keypad at any time, including during the Congressman's remarks, and you will be entered into the queue to ask that question. Or please feel free to email that question to us at info@businessfwd.org. And with that, I will hand it over to Congressman Schrader. Welcome, Congressman.
Oh, thank you very much, Liz, and I appreciate everyone's interest, frankly, in the very timely topic. Healthcare has been a bit of an issue for the last 7 years, certainly across the country, in the halls of Congress, businesses in particular, and with, frankly, just everybody at home trying to figure out where's the right balance between making sure everyone has affordable healthcare and at the same time making sure that we have a system that actually works. The Affordable Care Act, I think, arguably was very controversial when it was put together in 2009-2010. Incorporated a lot of ideas from all over the spectrum, healthcare experts that had been talking to us for years. Frankly, it incorporated Republican as well as Democratic concepts and ideas, although, as we all know, at the final vote, we did not get any Republican votes for the Affordable Care Act. However, since that time, elements of the bill have become very popular. While Obamacare has generally been derided, particularly by my Republican colleagues across the country for the last 6-7 years, people have gotten pretty comfortable, including my Republican colleagues, with making sure that people are not discriminated against with pre-existing conditions, that kids under age 26 could get on their parents' plan, although I've had a few parents not so keen on that. But and then we've had annual and lifetime limits are no longer part of the equation. And then there's other issues dealing with essential benefits, making sure we go after preventative health care so we're not just dealing with acute situations that come up, but hopefully preventing them from coming up and therefore having a healthier population and ideally health care not cost our country quite so much going forward. If you keep those things in any healthcare delivery system here in the country, it costs money. I think both Washington State and New York State, perhaps some others, found very starkly how you cannot just let people sign up for healthcare whenever they get sick or sustain an injury and have an affordable healthcare system. Washington State, tried that, I believe, in the 90s, and every single health insurer pulled out. They had no health insurance. So you need to have mechanisms to encourage people or require people or auto-enroll people, some way to get them on the healthcare system, just like you do for car insurance or homeowner insurance, you know, before the disaster strikes. But that is very controversial, you know, especially in a country that prides itself on individual freedoms and personal liberty. So that's been the crux of the issue. So where are we now? Well, as you all know, the House Republicans passed a health care reform proposal. Wasn't really a full repeal. As you guys know, the whole bill was a little over 1,000 pages. Their repeal bill was like 160 pages. So a lot of it was still in play. That was controversial. A lot of conservatives said, well, this is not repeal. I can't vote for this. A lot of moderates said it went too far in terms of some of the other proposals in Medicaid in particular. And the bill passes, barely passes the House, frankly, with, I think, 20 Republicans voting against it, no Democrats voting for it, even Blue Dog Democrats like myself. Goes to the Senate, and the Senate obviously has had some trouble coming up with a bill that will just even get a chance to be talked about on the floor, much less voted on the floor. Their first Better Care Act or whatever it was could not get the required votes or support, both from some far-right Republicans as well as some moderate Republicans. Their second iteration also did not garner support. The death knell was when Mike Lee and Jerry Moran came out against it, and along with, of course, Susan Collins and Rand Paul. And so at this point, as Liz indicated, we're going to have, I think the Senate is supposed to schedule it anyway, see if it happens, but scheduled to vote on a motion to proceed. And in Congress talk, that means before you can even talk about the substance of the bill, you have to get 60 votes, basically 50-plus votes on this. Now, let's see how to explain it to you guys. In most situations, it's a 60-vote threshold motion to proceed. But as you know or maybe remember, the Republicans have used a procedure the Democrats had used to originally pass the health bill, which was called reconciliation. Then you only require 50 plus one, a simple majority to proceed. But they're having trouble getting that. We'll see if they actually get that. I think it's scheduled for tomorrow or Wednesday. Long story short, the Republicans have focused on cutting back the taxes that were used to make sure the Affordable Care Act was paid for, and they also want to cut back Medicaid, which they consider an entitlement that's out of control. And really, to be honest, neither of those is the problem. I have not had any well-to-do individuals, Republican or Democrat, complain to me about the Medicare surcharge that wealthy people over $250,000 income are paying, or the 3.8% tax on passive investment above $250,000 in income that people are getting. And it's really not been part of the problems we've seen. And the problems we've seen have been pretty much about premium increases and higher deductibles on what we call the individual marketplace. That's been the drumbeat. I've had some of that in my district. I've had a ton of Republican friends complain that they're getting all these calls from middle class and upper middle class folks that don't get the subsidies that are in the health care bill, that this is just unaffordable now. They can't handle this, and their premiums are going through the roof. Some small business folks who are giving just catastrophic plans or a few hundred dollars to their employees, which is good, to help them buy health care, now are in this mandate situation and finding out that with the essential benefits, the health care that they're supposed to be offering their employees unfortunately costs a lot more than they think they can afford. And as a result, we've got all these pressures coming up on this individual marketplace. The healthcare bill is probably in its third or fourth year of actual implementation. Even though it was passed in 2010, it takes several years to write the rules. There was some delays in putting it out there. So the actual practice of the ACA has been relatively recent. So there's not a lot of data to base your premiums on if you're an insurance company. The insurance companies, I think, the first few years, the premium increases were not horrible. It did depend on where you were. Certain rural areas where there's not a lot of competition, they were substantial. But in a lot of the rest of the country that had a robust marketplace, not so much. My home state of Oregon, I think we had like 14 players. I think we have 10 or so at this particular point in time. But nonetheless, it with this uncertainty that we're now facing in Washington, D.C., the new president has indicated he wants to repeal the Affordable Care Act. My Republicans have been saying it for the last 7 years. So if you're an insurance company and you're trying to give insurance on the small group or particularly the individual marketplace, you're saying, Jesus, I don't know what the rules of engagement are. I've been losing money the last year or two because it's been questionable with these higher premiums and deductibles on the individual marketplace. I'll just stay with, you know, some of the small group market. I'll stay with big businesses. I'll stay with Medicare. I'll stay with Medicaid. Then they're all against repealing Medicaid. And then just let this individual marketplace disappear. So we're at a very interesting point where the Democrats heretofore have been saying, hey, we want, you know, ACA, it's great, really on balance, it's very good. We're just going to defend it. We don't want to talk about any of its flaws. Of course, our Republicans don't want to acknowledge any of the success that the Affordable Care Act has had and want to repeal it and replace it by putting 20 million Americans off of health care. That's really not a health care bill. So long story short, again, there are a group of Democrats who have reached out to a group of Republicans to come up with a solution for what the real problem is. That is that individual marketplace that is now bleeding over into the small group arena. And that means we've got to make that individual marketplace, which is only about 7 or 8% of the entire healthcare delivery system in the country, more stable so that that tail does not wag the dog, if you will. We have come up with a series of recommendations that some of which have been included in Republican proposals, some are still in the Affordable Care Act or were in the Act and then lapsed, that we think are the real key to getting this thing under control. We've consulted with the insurance companies, providers, and patient groups. First and foremost of those is to have a robust reinsurance program for higher risk individuals with pre-existing conditions that are skewing the marketplace. We don't have enough young people signing up for this individual marketplace. It's been unfortunately dominated by older, sicker people. So we've got to do like we did before, and many states have done. My state has done it. I think Alaska is doing it, which is set up a reinsurance market to spread that risk amongst the insurers so that these people don't skew the marketplace. That is estimated to drop premiums anywhere from 10 to 20%. The other big issue has been what we call cost-sharing reductions, fancy name for making sure that low-income Americans under 250% of poverty level, that's probably, $15,000 to $20,000 a year income, have the government help pay their copays and deductibles. Now, you all know everyone below 400% of poverty level gets some tax credits to help pay for their health care. They're called the subsidies or tax credits. But in addition to that, these very low-income people would get these copays and deductibles paid. The insurers have told us in no uncertain terms, if that goes away, premiums will increase 15 to 20%. It is currently in law that these get paid. It's controversial because of some wording when it was enacted, and there's a lawsuit on it. But our proposal says we should continue to make these payments so that these people stay in the healthcare system and don't cost us more by coming into their emergency clinics as they decide to drop their insurance altogether. The other piece I alluded to earlier, which is to make sure that everyone gets health care before they need it at the last minute. The individual mandate is not popular. Being told you have to buy health care is just not popular in America. I get that. This is not was not originally, as you all know, a Democrat idea. I believe Heritage Foundation and others have come up with it long before we did. So we're open to maybe auto-enrollment with an opt-out so that people would have the opportunity, because healthcare is complicated and applying for all this stuff is difficult, would automatically be enrolled. And if you don't like that, you can opt out, but of course you'll probably end up paying higher premiums in the course of your lifetime. And then we go to making sure that the healthcare system is more affordable, make sure there are more variations out there. Maybe people that are in the 55 to 65 range could buy into Medicare, pay more, obviously, than someone on Medicare, but could buy into it at some level. make sure that there may be more targeted premium supports for younger people so that they could buy into the system, make it more advantageous to them. We also talk about improving the marketplace itself, because there's been a lot of churn in the marketplace as people go on to the subsidies or fall into Medicaid, and there's a way maybe we could smooth that out, and making sure that in rural areas that the bidding areas for insurance contracts would include rural and urban areas, so rural areas are not left out in the cold, and several other pieces too. So it really gets to making sure we have reinsurance, we got the cost sharing going down, make sure people sign up, more flexible options, I think we even have HSAs in there, and make sure the marketplace is more stable. And catching ground, a lot of Democrats across the philosophical spectrum, not just new Democrats, but blue dogs like myself, as well as very progressive colleagues. And we've got a group of Republicans that are very interested too, because the bottom line is we got to fix the problem. The problem's the individual healthcare market. Maybe that's something we could do bipartisanly. Liz, back to you. Hello, Liz.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you now.
Hello?
Yes, there.
Oh, you can hear me now? Okay.
I can. Were you able to hear what I was saying?
Yeah, I believe so. That I think I heard you end your remarks and we were going to move to questions.
Sounds good.
Okay, sounds good. Okay, so just as a reminder, so anybody, if you'd like to ask a question, press 1 on your keypad, or you can email us your question at info@businessfwd.org. We're going to get started with a couple live questions. The first question comes from Hugh Campbell. When we call on you to ask a live question, please tell us your business and let us know where you're calling from. Hugh, your line is open.
Good afternoon. I'm a certified public accountant in the New York metropolitan area. Thank you, Congressman, for your time. There's a growing coalition of U.S. business leaders that have evolved over the past couple of years that contend that healthcare in America is crowding out the rest of the economy. Do you have a response regarding this contention?
I think that contention is accurate. The trajectory for healthcare, if you add Medicare, Medicaid, other healthcare programs, certainly with our veterans and our military folks, is escalating at a rapid rate. There's some evidence that the Affordable Care Act has moderated that increase. But again, I think to continue to moderate that increase is very important, so it doesn't crowd out all our other investments in economic development, transportation, education, and that's why we're pushing these reforms in the individual marketplace to bring the inevitable increases in health insurance back to a single digits and a much more sustainable rate.
Thanks. We'll do an emailed question next. This is from Laura Dawson. She wrote, you mentioned rural access to care in rural areas at the end of your remarks. Does your proposal or anything that you've seen explore alternative methods to address the opioid crisis? For example, ensuring patients have access to services like acupuncture that can also treat pain through their health insurance.
That's not actually part of our proposal. That has been addressed by Congress in general. One of the areas of bipartisan agreement, maybe it doesn't get a lot of press, is in dealing with the opioid epidemic. The last Congress, my Energy and Commerce Committee, passed out the 21st Century Cures Bill that added a bunch of money in for opioid treatment. And there's been a lot of discussion so far this Congress in the same committee about doing some preventative work and making sure that opioid prescriptions are done only when absolutely necessary. There's some evidence coming from our medical provider groups in different areas of the country. I can speak for Oregon that the number of prescriptions has dropped dramatically. I think as our physician friends become aware of the depth and severity and seriousness of the problem. Our bill, and I think the Affordable Care Act, do point to the fact that you want to keep this Medicaid system in place. The Medicaid expansion has been pretty successful, actually very successful in almost every state, both red and blue, that has decided to do it. And they're a big part of, at least in listening to our healthcare providers, Medicaid is a big part of being able to treat these guys. A lot of the folks that are on these prescription drugs, quite honestly, are Medicaid eligible, low-income Americans that have undergone some problems or whatever. So that part of the system to help pay for their treatment is just as important as just more money for opioid treatment. There has to be a system by which people can access it, and we've used that pretty extensively. Good comment. We will continue to work on that.
Thanks. Our next question is a live question. Kimberly Spillers, I think you're next in our queue. Go ahead and ask your question. Let us know where you're calling from and the name of your business as well.
Thank you, Liz. Again, my name is Kimberly Spillers. My husband and I have a home-based business in Southwest Iowa called Global Horizons. I'm sitting on my front porch right now, as a matter of fact, so I send you greetings from here. Congressman, thank you for your work, especially that it's bipartisan. My husband and I are community economic developers for rural areas, so I really appreciate the consideration that rural needs to be blended in. We're a small business. Most of the country is small business oriented. That's what runs our country. And so we're concerned about, we're currently uninsured. If it wasn't for the Affordable Care Act for a brief piece of time, there's a stipulation in the ACA that keeps us from being insured. So that's something I'd like to have a personal discussion with you about.
Sure.
So we have been uninsured for most of the last 10 years. We lost a business in the Great Recession, and so we're still climbing back out of that hole as community developers. In 2007, and I apologize, this is a little bit of background. In 2007, a national organization hired us to talk through financial security and health care, the elements that of the conversations that we had in the four lead-off primary caucus states with more than 1,000 people led to a lot of points that are in the ACA now. So my question related to that, and I'd love to have you follow-up conversation with you, is that from those 1,000 people, one of the things that we heard loudly and clearly is single payer. Do you have any read on whether or not that could ever be part of a conversation? And if so, we know how to lead discussions like that.
Thank you, Kimberly. Yeah, I think that could be at some point in time. We had tried that type of discussion back in 2010 when we were developing the Affordable Care Act. There, at that point, was not enough support for the single-payer type system. California has explored it. I know most recently it is very, very expensive, or at least the expansion of Medicare would be expensive, would require some real thoughtfulness about how to deal with our Medicaid population, which does not obviously have to pay premiums or co-pays, so we'd have to figure that piece out. And there's not a lot of appetite, quite honestly, on the other side of the aisle at all for that discussion. So we have tried to focus, taken a baby step, if you will, but a very important baby step, because as you point out, the Affordable Care Act has been pretty helpful and pretty successful in a variety of areas, but a very obvious glaring problem that both sides of the aisle understand is this individual marketplace, as you point out, bleeding over into the group market now. We need to take care of that. And I think if we can get some consensus on this one small but very key area, that will hopefully enable us to start to have more bipartisan discussions on the bigger picture and see where we need to go from there. So hopefully over this next week, there will be continued interest by our leadership, both sides of the aisle again, and different members that, okay, yeah, let's fix this area, make sure there's stability and certainty in the marketplace, let things calm down, then we can have a more rational discussion about where do we want to go in the long term for our healthcare system.
Thanks for that. Our next question is from Raj Sigamani. Raj, your line's open. Go ahead.
Hello. Thank you, Congressman, for taking my call, and really appreciate the bipartisan effort in trying to take this healthcare situation under control, which I kind of believe it is a challenge for not just the legislators, but also from the patient as well as for the providers. My interest comes mainly from the using telehealth and telemedicine to alleviate the resource crunches that we have in terms of healthcare providers. Is there any way that we can look at new legislation helping for us to leverage the advances that we have made in technology to bring healthcare access to more people at a lower cost?
Raj, absolutely. We just had a hearing last week, again, in the Energy and Commerce Committee and in my committee, my subcommittee on healthcare, about the opportunities and advantages of telehealth medicine. In my district back home in Oregon, I have, like I'm sure you have seen in your area, and everyone's probably seen little bits and pieces in their areas, where different providers are experimenting with telehealth. Certainly, if you've got rural parts of your state, it is almost critical for the providers who cannot be in the little town in the middle of the forest area to be able to get on the phone and talk to experts and show pictures or radiographs of this particular patient's issue and get help, get some immediate assistance. I think as we in business understand, that would be very low cost. You know, as opposed to having to run into the emergency clinic, where indeed some of these are not emergencies and could be either taken care of fully over the phone or could be told to wait till the next day when they go to their primary healthcare provider at much less cost. However, unfortunately, in budget lingo, the way things are marked up for how much they cost the federal government, telemedicine scores as a cost and not as a benefit, in that you have to obviously set up the system, cameras and video need to be put together, you have to hire some people to run the system and provide for the interaction between their location, where the patient is, and then where they're getting their help and advice from. But that all costs money, we'd all recognize that. What unfortunately the scoring system that is used in Congress does not recognize is the fact that it's saving you money in terms of emergency visits and expensive office visits and running all these tests that you may not need. So it is a problem to get to that. We are working on that, Raj. We're trying to find a way to score, frankly, obvious preventative health things. It was a big problem when we came up with the ACA, the preventative health stuff that we have in the Act that is definitely going to save a lot of people a lot of money, save the federal government and taxpayers a lot of money, could not be scored as a savings. And so we're working with the powers that be to see if we can't make a better case along those lines. But there is tremendous interest in telemedicine, and I think regardless of how much it does cost up front, you're going to see Congress moving in that direction.
Perfect. Thank you. Our next question is from Maria Castellanos. Maria, your line should be open.
Okay, thank you. Thank you so much, Congressman. My comment is I think that we really need to have more transparency and prohibit the use of those clauses where they give a hospital will give an advantage to a particular insurance company because they do volume. I mean, this happens all the time. I can go get an MRI at a walk-in clinic, a diagnostic center. If I go before 2 o'clock in the afternoon, this is really funny, I can get it for under $300. I had an accident last year in my car, and South Miami Hospital charged me well, it didn't charge me because GEICO paid, but it charged something like $7,000 or $8,000. One MRI, I was there less than 2 hours at the hospital. Most of the time was waiting to get in, and yet the bill was just astronomical. And
wow.
There was really nothing wrong with me. I just had a lot of bruising. So somehow we have to get into the details of these issues. This secretiveness that there is, this secret competitiveness that nobody divulges what they charge, so we can't shop for anything else. I'm sure that if we had a list, price list, where you're only you have to go by these price lists, and I'm able to shop. Well, I'd rather go to South Miami or to the regular Baptist Hospital, or I'd rather go to Kendall Regional Medical Center. I'm in Miami, Florida, and you know, there's a ton of hospitals, but I don't know because ahead of time it's so secretive that a lot of times it's cheaper for me to pay out of pocket. I mean, this has happened to me. It's cheaper for me to pay out of pocket than it is to go by the guidelines of my insurance company. So at the same time I'm paying for health insurance, I can't use it because they have these, like, for example, my insurance company, most of the time they only work with... Hello?
Yes.
Yep, you're still there. Go ahead.
They only contract with Jackson Memorial Hospital. So an MRI is $1,000 or $2,000 or $3,000. They tell me I have to pay my deductible before I can get anything. But I can go to the diagnostic clinic and get the same MRI for $300, for less than $300.
Right.
So that's what's so outrageous about this whole system.
Sure. Well, that shouldn't be happening. That shouldn't be happening. I totally agree with you, Maria. Matter of fact, there is a push again in our committee to start talking about transparency and make sure that when you're being transparent as a hospital or as a provider over what your charges are, or frankly, I would suggest what your outcomes are. In other words, it's not just how much it costs, but are you getting good results? You know, who's getting the better results for treating heart disease, who's getting better results for treating asthma, who's getting better results treating diabetes. And, you know, frankly, as a consumer, I would like to know that. So in addition to how much it's going to cost me or my insurance company up front, there is a push to be doing that. Actually, some states are already doing that. For instance, in my state of Oregon, for many years now, the hospitals have put, you know, their charges, if you will, online. They also talk about the types of results they're getting, and I think that's very important. We have in Oregon now, due to one of the healthcare waivers that a lot of states apply for, to use their Medicaid dollars more creatively and, frankly, more flexibly and more effectively. We have these coordinated care organizations where a group of doctors or hospitals or dentists or therapists will come together and form a group, coordinated care group. They will get a bundled payment from the Medicaid system, and then they will decide how they're going to go about distributing those dollars. That is discoverable, frankly, in a transparent way. And more importantly, these coordinated care organizations will actually list healthcare outcomes. Are they reducing emergency visits? Are they making sure that kids are getting dental care? What's happening with a chronic obstructive pulmonary disease? What's happening with heart disease? All these things. That's the new wave. And Maria, I tell you, that is exactly where we're going to get our greatest savings, is by being transparent and open, measuring good outcomes, and frankly sharing that knowledge about, well, geez, how did this group in Oregon get such a good outcome, where this group in, you know, Texas or wherever, or Miami, is perhaps not getting quite so good outcomes and actually charging more. That is where this coordinated care is where the true savings are going to be had in whatever healthcare delivery system we go forward with. And we stay with this value-added type of proposition, just like you do in business. You don't get paid for unless you get good results, right? You don't get, you know, you lose clients, you lose people if you don't get good results and you charge too much. This is exactly where the healthcare system's going. Last year, Congress actually passed a bill called MACRA, and it begins begins the march away from just fee-for-service reimbursement to healthcare providers by your federal government with your tax dollars to reimbursing providers that get good outcomes, that are getting better results, which is exactly the way the system should be. So stay tuned, Maria. Hopefully that march will continue, and I think the more we get to that, the more savings we're going to have and the better quality healthcare we're going to have.
Thanks. We've got another emailed question. This question is from Jack Davis, and he's saying, it seems like there are some Republican health care proposals that could also help lower costs, for example, medical malpractice, some lower provisions for coverages with penalties, not sure exactly what he means by that, and using the national buying power of Medicare and the ACA to lower drugs costs. Is there an opportunity to work across the aisle on some of those, and do you think that they could be combined in this proposal?
Those are good suggestions, Jack. I think the answer is yes. The devil's in the details, how you word these things. I know there is a lot of interest in making sure that doctors, physicians, nurse practitioners, pharmacists, you name it, that are providing health care within the standards of their practice discipline should be protected and not be sued just because they didn't get a good result. Actually, I had my own small business for 33 years. I was a veterinarian in the great state of Oregon, and there were practice standards by which we all operated. And if you practiced within those confines, it was a great protection for you in a court of law when someone in the legal community or some disgruntled constituent, because the results didn't work out as well as they would have liked, come after you. You should have some arguable presumptive defense if you did what, frankly, every other practitioner does as far as how they work up that case. Because, unfortunately, as we all know, in the real life and biology and healthcare, not everything works out the way you want it to. So there's interest, I think, in stuff along these lines that could hopefully lower our healthcare costs to you and I, and frankly, the liability insurance to a lot of our healthcare providers. I think the national buying power thing is probably very real. I had a bill that we passed already this year to drive down the healthcare costs for some generic drugs that, different companies would buy up a generic drug that has been on the market forever, but it's only one manufacturer, and then they jack the price up. The EpiPen issues that we've seen here recently, where we actually have helped solve that issue. But there's more that can be done. I think if you encourage people to use good generics, that'll be a huge cost saving. We have to come up with a way to pay for these very cutting edge new brand name drugs that are lifesavers for a lot of people, but cost thousands and thousands of dollars a month. We can't afford that either as a taxpayer or as an individual. So I think that putting some sort of national buying power or pooling resources, either as associations or the government as a whole, is probably high on the list of one of the options we'll use to try and get healthcare costs under control.
Thanks. We just have about 4 minutes left, so I'm going to try to hit a couple more questions. If you could all be quick with your questions, that would be great. Next, we're going to go to Patricia McGowan. Patricia, your line's open.
Yes. My name is Patricia McGowan of the McGowan Company. I'm an educational consultant. Thank you so much, Congressman, for affording us this opportunity. My question is very short. I want to make sure that a bipartisan group has at its disposal, all the information on how it would impact the inner city schools as well as the rural county schools if we impact negatively the Affordable Care Act, particularly Medicaid. Do they have this information at their disposal so that they can truly understand?
Well, that's a really good point, Patricia. And the answer is hopefully it's folks like you that come and visit us and give us a dose of reality. We have had, in the last 2 weeks, a bunch of folks coming back to Washington, D.C. from school districts around the country talking about Medicaid in particular, the expansion Medicaid, how it has helped a lot of schools. Some of the proposals by my colleagues on the other side of the aisle cut not just the expansion population, which is mostly adults, but also basic Medicaid, which is 50% children. And good news is a lot of school health clinics, a lot of school counselors are knocking on our doors here in Washington, D.C., talking to us about how important Medicaid is to making sure that they can take care of the kids in their schools. Frankly, it's the only health care that a bunch of these kids get. You know, there's a huge proportion of kids that are homeless that go to school these days. It just boggles my mind as an older individual that there are kids now that, frankly, don't have a home. And I'd argue there's a huge percentage of kids, unfortunately, that don't have functional parents. And for them to come to school without health care, without good nutrition, the schools are oftentimes the only place, the only stable environment that they have. And then you come summer vacation, what happens to these kids? It's I think that the message needs to be told. And again, frankly, you guys, Patricia, are a better messenger than we are. So I'd urge you to reach out to your legislators, reach out to your Congress folks, and tell the story about how important different aspects of the Affordable Care Act and Medicaid are to making sure our kids get a good start.
Great, thanks. I just want to ask this one question here at the end because I think a lot of people may be interested in it. Someone from Texas wrote, in North Texas, the available plans to the Affordable Care Act are very limited. In particular, there are very few doctors in Dallas and especially the surrounding area. And while the GOP leadership in Texas may have contributed to this problem, there are definitely structural problems at play. So I think he's asking here, does this proposal or others that you are aware of do anything to increase the number of doctors who will take insurance plans or to encourage them to do so?
I hope the answer is yes. By stabilizing the marketplace, it will make it easier for physicians to provide the necessary services. We talked on this call about telemedicine. If there are a few providers, at least if you have a nurse practitioner or pharmacist or someone in your small community area that can tune in, that would be a huge help. I know in my state of Oregon, even without our proposal that we're talking about now in D.C., the Affordable Care Act has led to a huge increase in rural health care. It has been a lifeline for rural hospitals that often deal with people that are much lower than the average median income in this country. Rural hospitals in my state were closing and having a tough time making a profit with the expansion of the Affordable Care Act and the Medicaid expansion. They are now consistently profitable. I don't think overly so, frankly, but they're generally better off. And in the entire state of Oregon, I mean, if you divide, you know, that square state that's between California and Washington, if you cut that state in half, actually in thirds, the western third is the most populated area, and a good friend of mine in Congress has the other two-thirds, which is just high desert. And there's nothing out there, really. There's only one town of any significance. And yet they have this coordinated care organization I talked to earlier in the call where doctors and a couple of the hospitals and a couple of the satellite hospitals that they've got and spread out through this huge geography, my state's a big, big state, are able to make this system work. So getting rid of the Affordable Care Act would be a huge, huge blow to rural America. Texas, your state of Texas, unfortunately suffers doubly because Texas was one of those states that decided not to expand the Medicaid population. And you can argue that, why are you taking care of able-bodied people? But I'd argue that, a lot of veterans in that group that are down on their luck, there's a lot of people trying to provide for their families that are in that group. And that money is the flex money that allows different Medicaid organizations, homegrown local groups in your state, not Washington, D.C., but coming up from your state to do the health care things that they could only dream about before. So I think between our proposal and the basic tenets of the Affordable Care Act, they're the key to making sure rural health care delivery continues to grow and deliver, much like it has in the urban areas for a long, long time.
Well, great. Thank you, Congressman, for your time, and thanks to all of you for taking time out of your busy schedules to join us. Before we go, one quick announcement. Please check your email for a recording of today's call and a quick survey. We always like to try to improve the quality of our programming with your advice. Also, if we did not get to your question today and you didn't email it to us already, please do so at info@businessfwd.org, and we'd be happy to try and get that question answered for you. So again, thanks to Congressman Schrader and to all of you for joining the call. We look forward to working with you again soon. Have a good afternoon.